You're listening to a download from the outdoorstation.co.uk. Number 417.
Welcome back to the Outdoor Station and part two of the interview with Laura Bingham regarding her 7,000 kilometre cycle trip across South America with no money. If you haven't checked out part one, please do have a listen as it'll all make much more sense. Links to everything discussed are in the show notes on the Outdoor Station, and there's plenty there. Photos, Twitter, videos, etc. There's lots to discuss. As I mentioned last podcast, we're now also starting a monthly competition to win some great outdoor gear. So listen out for that during the show. So without further ado, let's get back to our interesting conversation with Laura. The average day that you went through then, sort of the cycling is obviously going to take a certain amount of time with an effort due to the nature of the terrain and the altitude. How did you feel when you got to a point where you either need to ask for food or you need to ask for accommodation or needed to ask for whatever, asking people for help?
Through Ecuador, Peru and Bolivia, I felt like the biggest burden in the world. I felt like no one wanted me. I felt like I was a waste of space, that it would just be better if I fell into a hole and didn't come out because everyone hated me. Obviously, there were the occasional people that completely went out of their way and went above and beyond and made me feel so loved. And I felt good within those few days. But as soon as I left them, I was then back out with that really, really negative feeling of just being the biggest burden because no one was smiling at me. Everyone was honking for me to get out of the way in the road. Everyone was just trying to sort of, it felt like get rid of me. And I just felt so negative about myself. And then when I hit Paraguay, everyone started tooting at me rather than honking. So it was like little toot, 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 toots. And they'd be waving out of their window and putting their thumb up and really smiling and just being really happy to see me. And I just felt like I wasn't a burden there. And it felt like people were genuinely happy that I was cycling through their country and being in their country. And they're such a proud, wonderful nation that's just really happy. And it was only in Paraguay that I started feeling good about myself again, and really enjoying the experience. And then when I got to Argentina, the same, you know, I'd meet someone in one town and then they'd phone their friend in four towns away and I'd cycle to their friend's house and then their friend would take me in and they'd phone their friend in four towns away and I'd cycle to their friend's house. So it felt like people cared more about me and were just happy that I was there.
So when people were rejecting you then, sort of more to the beginning of the trip by the sound of it, do you think it was because they were expecting you to be a tourist and buy stuff, or just the fact that you asked them for help, they rejected you, or they just didn't like gringos?
They didn't particularly like gringos, didn't really want the burden, didn't want the hassle of having to give someone food or having to give someone a place to sleep or a patch in their garden. The amount of people that wouldn't let me camp in their garden was really, really high. I had one guy spit at me when I asked to camp in his garden. And I was like, oh, I'm just asking to camp in your garden, nothing more. But it was quite shocking that people wouldn't let me camp just in their garden.
So did you then choose to wild camp then, camp in sort of more remote places between villages?
No. Most of the time it would be marshland or there'd be cattle in the field or it would be a cliff face or it would be fenced in. We always sought out the landowner's permission. So we'd just keep cycling and keep cycling and keep cycling until someone said, yeah, you can camp in our garden. You'd think it'd be easier to wild camp, but it was actually quite difficult trying to find a place that wasn't fenced in or didn't have a problem in it. Mm. I wanted to try and be as respectful as possible.
No, it is interesting talking to different people that have experiences in different parts of the world. The areas that where wild camp is, or wild camping is either taken as the norm or is acceptable, as opposed to every part of the land is cultivated. So give us an idea then. You've obviously, there are sequences of people that held your hand, looked after you, as you said, passed you on from one friend to another as you carried on with your trip. That I can understand and we can sort of visualise. But give us an idea, give us sort of half a dozen ideas of some of the wide and varied menus that you had to suffer when things were really, really bad.
The wide and varied menu. So there was a lovely chap that bought us some food at a food stall. That was intestines, heart, liver, like anal tubes or whatever it is.
Uncooked?
Cooked. Okay. They were nice. They were quite crispy, which it wasn't too bad. But seeing all of like the arteries and bits and bobs was a bit like, but it was fine. I kept eating maggots by accident, eating fruit out of trees, especially guavas. In the end, I didn't even bother with guavas because I'd take a bite out of them, there'd be loads of maggots in them. I ate a lot of stuff that I found on the side of the road. There was a bag of crisps that I found that tasted like plastic. I think they were supposed to be Wotsits of some kind, but they just tasted like little balls of white plastic. But I ate those. I pretty much ate anything I found. Thankfully, the South Americans, they don't see a problem with throwing rubbish out of their window. So the roads are just laden with piles of rubbish. So I just go ciphering through the rubbish or just keeping an eye out on the side of the roads. And I'd find crisps and biscuits. And I found a box of 64 cans of tuna, which that was pretty much my entire protein source for the trip. Very heavy to carry, though. Loads of fruit that had fallen off the back of lorries. I found juice that had fallen off the back of lorries. I found a carton of chocolate milkshake. I ate a lot of stale bread in Ecuador. I hadn't had lunch or breakfast. I hadn't had dinner or breakfast. And I ended up going into a bakery and just crying my eyes out. And he gave me two bags of stale bread. And that was my food source for about 4 days.
So when Ed takes you out for a meal, then he knows you're a cheap date.
True. I'm pretty fine with eating most things. I don't really fuss about what goes in my trap.
In your preview video, you mentioned that you were considering or would consider roadkill and cooking it and whatever else. Did you ever have to do that?
Yeah, I killed a chicken. I was cycling along and this chicken ran in front of my bike and then ran in front of me, saw me and freaked out, and then ran the other way, saw a car coming, freaked out, ran my way, freaked out because it saw me again, then ran the other way, and by which time the car was half on it, and it broke its leg. So this chicken was sort of half alive with its broken leg trying to like claw out of the road, and I just thought, oh god, there's dinner. But I didn't want to kill it, but I had to kill it to put it out of its misery because it was clearly in pain. And then I also thought, that's dinner. But unfortunately, I found it. That happened at 11 o'clock in the morning. So I got a rock and I smashed its head. And then I had to sort of wrap it up in one of my pieces of clothing and douse it in cold water to try and keep it cold so it wouldn't like go off during the day. And then I tied it to my stuff and cycled with it for the day, just making sure I stopped in the shade, and I just kept it wet so it didn't go off. And I ate it for dinner.
No stuffing?
No, it didn't taste very good. It was quite, you can tell it was surviving off the crappy bits of life.
Your sisters that joined you, and Ed obviously, mm-hmm. How did, obviously this was your expedition and you set out with certain expectations, and over a period of time, as we all do when you do a long trip, things start to evolve and certain things become natural for you. Your sisters joined you, I think, later on in the trip. Ness is obviously an experienced traveller, Ed's an experienced traveller. But how did your sisters take to life on the road? Was it the first time they'd done something like that?
100%. My sisters have never travelled alone. They've only ever gone on sort of little holiday excursions. So I was excited for them to come and experience this with me because they could understand how hard it like how hard what I do is, and that it isn't just a lot of pretty pictures. And one of like Claire, my sister, she came out and she went, "It looks so fun from the photos, but it's not." And she was like, "You keep smiling in your photos, but you're not happy. It's not a happy thing." And I was like, "Well, no one likes a photo where you're frowning." So yeah, I think they definitely understand what I go through now, and then it's not as easy. And it was quite bizarre because I would say to Ed or Ness, "I'm here, meet me in this town in the communal house or at the police station," or I'd say sort of a rough place where I was and I'd just say, "Meet me there." And Ness and Ed, they'd be the same. They'd go, "Okay, I'll see you there." And then that would be it. Whereas my sisters, I had to pre-write the different options of travel that they could take to get to me. And then I'd have to sort of guide them through the whole process of getting to me. And they both were sort of panicking, trying to find me, trying to get to me. And my sister Claire, she said she cried pretty much the whole way because she was so scared. But they all managed to get to me. But it was only with Ness, because she's an experienced cyclist and an experienced sort of expeditionist, if you can say, that I realized my true potential. Like, we were just going for it. Before that, the maximum I'd done was about 80, 90 kilometers a day. And then with Ness, we managed to do about 140 kilometers regularly. And it was just a real example of good teamwork and two people that sort of knew what they were doing and efficient in what they were doing. And it was just incredible. And then I had my sisters come along who, Claire was quite fit, who were quite fit, but they weren't used to carrying any weight on a bike. Like my sister Sarah just cried so much, bless her. She cried every day and she just wanted to give up all the time, which is what I was like at the start, but it's really hard to remember that when you've already been through so much.
And are they much older than you, your sisters?
Yeah, I'm 23 and Claire is 9 years older than me. So she's, 32? And Sarah's 12 years older than me, so she's 35.
And you took on the mum figure, did you?
Pretty much, yeah. I had to definitely be the mum figure. I had to find all the food because neither one spoke Spanish. And I had to guide them as to where we should camp and how to make fire and, you know, setting up tent. And it was weird being like the true sort of leader in an expedition and not just being a partner.
I bet when you've come back, they tell a completely different story.
We haven't really spoken about it that much, to be fair.
Oh, they're not speaking to you. Well, that's
we don't really recount this story.
Don't mention it.
No, apparently I'm a bitch most of the time. And my sister Claire, watching through the sort of the videos, there's so many of her going, "She's really mean and she's just a bitch all the time."
When Ed joined you, I understand he had a bit of an accident which took a bit of a nasty turn, which was probably the only serious accident you had across the whole way.
Yeah, it was the only one. Well, Cho got hit by sort of sideswiped by a minivan, but he got up from that, whereas Ed, he got sideswiped by a truck and he was on the floor. And I just, all of the medical training I've had just didn't come close to preparing me for it, especially because I obviously care about him so much. And seeing him in front of me completely white, I thought he had internal bleeding because he'd just gone so white and sort of sweaty and clammy. And then all of these Bolivians stopped and were trying to be helpful and trying to help. And I kept saying, "Call an ambulance." And they were like, "What ambulance?" And I'm like, "Call an ambulance." And they were like, "What do you mean?" And I'm like, "How do you get to a hospital?" And they were like, "Oh, we drive, but there's a health center down the road." And I was like, "Just call a bloody ambulance. We need to go to hospital." And they were like, "Well, put him in the back of the van and then we can take him to the health center." And I was like, "But I don't know if he has a neck injury, if he has a spinal injury. I shouldn't move him." And this guy's like trying to pull him up, trying to get him up. And I was like, "No, because he could have a spinal injury and we could be making this so much worse." And in the end, this guy just like pulled him up and there's Ed like just in so much pain. And they put him in the back of this van and we're going on this muddy track road and it's just bouncing all over the place. And I can imagine Ed in the back, so much pain. And we get to this health centre and I call the number on the board. Bear in mind, it's like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I call this doctor or person and I say that my fiance has been hit by a truck. And this voice goes, yeah, I'm on my way. And I was like, are you a doctor? Are you a nurse? How long are you going to be? Is there an ambulance coming? What's the procedure? Hello. And when she came, she just stared at him for about 5 minutes. And like, by now, a good 40 minutes has gone on. And I'm just thinking, if he has internal bleeding, he could have like bled out by now. And it was very bizarre being in a country that didn't have the same efficient system that we have. Like, if something goes wrong, you call 999 and an ambulance is with you within sort of minutes and they take you straight to the hospital. They don't move your head or anything because you could have like X, Y, and Z injury. Whereas these guys, and even the ambulance was just a 4x4 with the seats down. It was incredible.
And obviously the outcome was good in the end. Did you just dump all the bike stuff on the side of the road then when you did this?
No, we put them in the back of the, I put them in the back of the car that gave me a lift and we left them in the health center. And then obviously Ed went to hospital. So he had to use his card to pay for x-rays and stuff. And then I was properly concerned because I was like, does this count as me using money? Is this like a breach in the whole thing? And I spoke to sort of Ness and several people and they said, no, you can't help what happens to Ed. He's your support crew technically, so he spent money on him, so I don't think that counts. But we ended up going back to the health center about 8-9 o'clock, and the health center was all locked up and we couldn't find anyone to unlock the health center and get our stuff out. So Ed didn't even have shoes on. He was in shorts and a t-shirt. And I was in shorts, a t-shirt and a sort of a mid-layer jacket with shoes. And we were just walking around the streets of this little village without any painkillers. Ed, all of the painkillers and stuff were in with the bikes. All of our clothes, Ed's shoes, our sleeping bags were all with the bikes that were all locked up that we wouldn't be able to get until the next morning. So we walked around the streets and then this lady took us in and gave us dinner and a bed to sleep in, thankfully. And then we went back the next morning, freezing. It's very cold at 3,000 meters with no shoes or clothes on. I managed to get our stuff back.
Wow. Well, there's a story and a half. So presumably getting on the bike the following day and actually setting off must have been, your heart must have been in your mouth in case it happened again or, you know, he suffered.
Ed didn't particularly, he still hasn't really recovered now. He sneezes and still has really sharp rib pain, but he couldn't cycle after he was in so much pain. And we were about 80 kilometers away from La Paz, which was where he was due to be flying out of the next 2 days later. So he had to hitchhike into La Paz, found a place to sleep, and then waited for Ness to come. And then Ness and I hitchhiked back out of La Paz to the place that he got hit by the van and then cycled from there.
Gosh. So he's obviously serious rib injuries.
I think so. He got x-rayed and they said he's fine. And then he got x-rayed again in La Paz after I'd left with Ness because he was allowed to sort of use money again. So he checked into a hotel for his last night and got another x-ray. But apparently he's fine. There's no broken or fractured ribs or anything, but there's a huge scar on his back and he's still in a lot of pain when he sneezes, which is weird.
And did the truck driver stop or did they carry on?
See, that's the weird thing, because I saw the first one that just missed him and I thought, oh, that was close. And by the time I would just finish that thought, the second van came and knocked him off. Whereas the second van then stopped. And I was like, what the hell's wrong with you? And he was like, that wasn't me. That was the van in front. Well, that was the truck in front. And I was like, what? And then because everything happened so quickly, and when someone keeps telling you one story, you're like, well, maybe that is true. And I didn't want to accuse someone and be like, you're the one, you need to pay for all the hospital fees because it's your fault if it wasn't him. So So I didn't want to point the finger, but I think it was the guy that stopped. But he blamed it on the truck driver before.
Every month, we're holding a special competition where you can win some fabulous outdoor gear. It's a great way to support the Outdoor Station, as we receive a small percentage from every entry, and you have a chance to win a great prize. During the month of November, the prize is an Evinnue Titanium Non-Stick Twin Pan Set, consisting of a 1300 and a 900 milliliter titanium pan, with a combined weight of only 296 grams, valued at £135. Simply answer the following question and text in your A, B or C answer before the closing date of the 30th of November and you will be automatically entered. You can enter a maximum of 5 times from the same mobile phone number. So this month's question is, the new President of the United States is A, Donald Duck, B, Donald Trump or C, Ronald McDonald?
To be in with a chance of winning, all you have to do is text OUTDOORS and your answer of A, B or C to 82055. Or post your answer with your name and contact phone number to Competition, The Outdoors Station, Unit 19 Signet Business Centre, Hanley Swan, Worcester, WR80EA. Entries are open to anyone aged 16 plus and you must have the bill payer's permission. Texts cost £1 plus your standard network rate and the competition closes at the end of each month. Entries received after that date will not count, but you may still be charged. The winner will be contacted within 3 days of the competition closing and they may appear in future programmes. For full rules plus terms and conditions, please go to theoutdoorstation.co.uk/competitions.
So you've got this drama unfolding in front of you. You're emotionally involved with the person that's receiving this particular injury. At the back of your mind, you're also trying to gather as much media information to make a story for TV regarding this particular trip. Your mind must be all over the place, because do you film it? Do you go checking Ed? You know, what exactly do you do?
I did feel really bad and guilty about the whole filming it thing. But Ed and I are quite similar. And when something happens, it's just an automatic, quick, get the camera out. Because if something bad has happened, at least there's possibly some tiny bit of good that could come out of it. So I did, yeah, sort of as soon as he got hit by the truck, after obviously going to him, crying, putting my head on his chest, and then him going, "Ow, Laura, get off, that hurts." And then me going, "Oh God, I can't do anything right." I then got up and got the camera and started filming. But it is really bizarre being with loads of people and a doctor trying to film the situation, because you just look like a really greedy sort of film hungry person that has no heart. But in mine and Ed's world, if you can do something good out of it, as in filming, creating sort of an entertainment and interesting part of the journey that really does represent what could happen on a trip like this, it is a good thing to film it, but it does make you feel a bit greedy and like camera hungry.
Well, it's a bit like a war reporter. It's the guilt that goes along with it, you know, although it's all part and parcel of the story and there's nothing really you can do at that particular moment in time. The guilt that goes along with having to detach yourself from that particular moment to try and make sure you've got a good picture. It's very hard to go through, isn't it?
It is.
Mm. But moving on, you know, you succeeded on the trip. You arrived at Buenos Aires. I presume you did a bit of dancing. A bit of tango, a bit of salsa.
I had about 2 days before I flew out, so we stopped about in the afternoon. We got to the coast and I put my hand in and then it started raining, so I was like, bye. Cycled to the nearest hotel and went and stayed in that hotel. They gave us some funny looks when we walked in there, because we were just dirty and smelly with these really dirty bikes. And then we went to McDonald's and had a McDonald's. And then we went and saw a tango show, which was amazing. And then my sister left that following morning. And then I spent the entire day trying to find bike boxes to put the bikes back in for my flight the following morning.
So you've given away a lot of gear, obviously, in the 7,000 kilometres. Just touching on gear at the moment, comparing with what you started with, what you finished with, what would you say, how would you describe your systems? We like to talk about systems, clothing systems, sleep systems, camp systems, etc., etc. So did you whittle it down to two sets of clothes, one for wearing, one for dry? How did it work for you?
Yeah, about two sets of clothes. I had two T-shirts, a string top, a skirt, like a long flowy skirt that I wore on my sort of days off, if you will. And when I was washing other clothes, and my sort of relaxed clothes was that skirt. I had two pairs of cycling shorts, and I pretty much did everything in those cycling shorts. I'd go into the shower and wash them on me, and then I'd get out and they'd dry if I was in hotter climates. They'd dry on me, and then a bit of the time I'd sleep in them, which is embarrassing. But they lasted 4 months. 4 months with constant wear. And then I saved the second pair of shorts for the last sort of month so I could finish on the finishing line without people being able to see through them.
Wow. And presumably they're padded cycling shorts, are they?
Yeah.
And what about, did you change the seat on the bike? Did you have a gel seat to make things a bit more comfortable on those roads?
No, not really. It was a bit of a puffy saddle. It wasn't too hard, and it was quite wide at the back. But yeah, I couldn't really buy a new saddle.
Okay, and your camping, did you took a tent, did you? Am I right in saying you took a tent?
Yeah, we took two tents. Cho and I took a tent each, and so obviously being male and female. And then when Ed came, he took the second tent back with him. Yep, he took the other tent back with him.
And then
I didn't need it. Being with my friends and sisters, we just slept in the same tent for company.
Okay, and do you know which tent it was?
It was the Rab. It was the Rab single skin sort of Andes tent, which is a wonderful, wonderful tent. But I would definitely recommend taking a double skinned tent with you, because a single skinned tent is not very waterproof.
Is that because, are we talking about condensation or are we talking about waterproof?
Condensation.
Yeah. Well, two people inside it's going to be pretty tough going. And you said you got attacked on a beach somewhere, I believe. Was that while you're in one of the tents?
Yeah.
And how about cooking? Because you said you made a fire several times and cooked and so on. What did you take with you as a sort of a cooking system to allow you anything you might find along the way?
Bless Ed. I gave him a lovely Christmas present of this double set cooking pot with a sort of a lever, and I took that with me. So thanks to him for his Christmas present. So it was literally just I took about six lighters with me. I started with six lighters and these two cooking pots, and that was it. And I took a 1 liter lock and lock Tupperware with a spoon to eat out of. And I would just make a fire every mealtime, really.
Okay, so if you were advising yourself now, planning this trip, if you were about to do this and your wiser, more experienced head is talking to yourself, what would you actually limit yourself down to and actually get rid of?
Well, by the end, I had pretty much everything I needed, and which was very sort of a quarter of the clothes that I left with. Unfortunately, the camera gear I couldn't avoid. I needed everything that I had, and my miscellaneous and first aid kit. I slimmed that down to what I literally needed. So in my first aid kit, I had a lot of paracetamol and ibuprofen. And a lot of, I had two, three courses of stomach antibiotics, of skin antibiotics, general antibiotics, because I couldn't go to a pharmacist and just buy them over the counter. I had to be prepared for everything. And sleeping bag and tent. So in cooking wise, I really, really, really wish I had one of those sort of gas boilers that you just put gas in and you cook on it, because we camped with someone, another cyclist that was cycling around the world, and he had one of those and he cooked his dinner in like 4 minutes, whereas it took me and Cho about 15 minutes to get the fire started, and then it took the fire about another 10 minutes to cook the rice, and then we put tuna with it. So our cooking time was at least half an hour, 40 minutes every time we cooked, whereas he had his meal cooked and eaten in 15 minutes, which was, I wish I could have had one of those, but I just couldn't rebuy the fuel. I couldn't buy the petrol all of the time, so it would have just become useless.
I was going to say, it would have defeated the object, wouldn't it, really?
Yeah, So
you could have, in a sort of a technical equipment, camera equipment aside, you could easily have reduced your four panniers and your trailer down to two or three panniers by the sound of it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, if I was going with money and not really filming it, I could have easily put everything in two panniers.
Right. Okay. And did you actually need the medical kit, apart from obviously the accident that happened to Cho and to Ed? Did you need any of those other things you mentioned?
Not really. The medical kit, I'd slimmed down to sort of essential antibiotics and really sort of essential items. And even those I didn't particularly use, but I didn't feel safe going without the real basics just in case. But I got rid of the IV stuff, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
And the saline solution.
So you returned from your trip. Obviously, you've been doing the sort of media rounds and speaking to various people and podcasts and, I'm sure, news interviews and so on. And cycling, I'm sure. Cycling magazines have been very interested in your story. How are you getting on with actually putting it together as a production? Has anybody taken you up on that?
The production company that I was with, unfortunately, they sort of got rid of their adventure department, which is why Ed has consequently moved from them as well. And he has started his own production company with a friend of his, and they're co-producing his next series. And through that one, they've got my footage, and hopefully they'll be doing something with it. But it's always such a long game in TV. Like the Great British Bake Off took, I think it was 3 or 4 years before it got on TV. And look how much of a success that was. So just TV just takes a long time.
And so do you think that you're one of the new generation, I suppose Ed as well, actually, you're sort of a modern adventurers. Do you think these days trying to make a career out of adventuring in the way that you're going about it is more about being a social media expert and getting a high profile from a social media point of view more than actually doing the adventuring almost?
Unfortunately, I think that's very true. I have two very, very wonderful publicists and then sort of an agency, and they put a lot of emphasis on getting really, really good photos, which I did. And they said if it wasn't for the good photos that I managed to get, they wouldn't have any luck trying to get my story in a magazine, because people only really care about the photos of the trip rather than the actual trip. So you can do a very small trip and have amazing photos, and you can be in a lot of amazing magazines, or you can do an incredible trip with absolutely no photos, but no one's really going to write about it or do much about it because you haven't got any photos. So it's the unfortunate part of this world that you have to really play the social media game and try and put really interesting content out there and get loads of amazing photos and footage to go alongside of it, because unless you can show all of the goods and ups and downs to people, they don't particularly care.
And where does this leave you, and Ed in some respects now, as a modern adventuring couple? Your lifestyle is presumably planning your next trips, individual next trips you're doing. But on a day-to-day basis, is it a media circus of interviews like this, or are you just trying to get through from one problem to the next?
It's funny, though, because we keep talking about it, and it just feels like we don't really have jobs. Because we wake up in the morning, depending on what we've got to do that day, it could be a really, really busy day driving from here, there and everywhere. But most of the mornings we get up, when we want to, and then sit at the computer the whole day emailing or talking to people and trying to resource things and plan things. For him, not as much, because all of his are on TV. So he has a company, the production company, deal with all of the logistics, but he spends a lot of time doing interviews and media stuff, and then trying to create other businesses and brand endorsements as well. So it feels like a job, but it doesn't feel like a job, which is amazing. And that's when you know you're doing exactly what you should do in life, and it doesn't particularly feel like a job. But there is a certain persistence. There's a lot of no's in it, and you have to keep just plugging away.
Well, I was just thinking, as you were saying that, with all the relationships you have to have with brands, or feel you have to have with brands to perhaps to complete the task, it sounds almost like it takes some of the adventuring out of the adventure.
Yeah, there's a lot of approaching brands and not taking the no's personally, because they get so many people coming to them and trying to offer them something that another person can't. And there are a lot of people in the adventure world that can offer them almost the exact same as what I can offer them. And it's just about trying to create an idea where you're worthy of their brand and where you are indispensable to them and where they can see the marketing benefits of pairing with you, which can be harder, which can be really, really hard. And there's a lot of companies that just say no, 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 because they have all of their money and sort of all of their budgets tied up sort of a year in advance. So it can be a very difficult game trying to partner with brands, partner with the right brands.
Well, it's been fascinating talking to you, and thank you very much indeed for taking the time. It's been an interesting story to hear about the actual trip itself, but also a lot of the background feelings and things that you went through. But of all the things that I could have asked you, what should I have asked you?
Most people tend to ask me what was sort of the craziest thing I saw, what was the most interesting thing I saw. A lot of those, what was. But I really enjoyed your questions, because they were more logistics based, of how the trip went and how I planned and how I actually went about it, which I really enjoyed answering, because most people haven't asked me those more logistical questions. What you could have asked me is, was it worth it? And to respond, it would be yes, but I would never fucking do it again.
And why?
Because I would never, ever wish upon anyone 5 months living on the streets with nothing. It's the most soul-destroying thing that you can put yourself through, of that whole burden situation and not being able to choose what you eat. I came back and had a huge problem with supermarkets, because we went into a supermarket when we got back, and I picked up a bag of carrots because I wanted carrots, and I started crying, and I had to pretend to look at bacon for about 5 minutes until I stopped crying. And then I went and picked up yogurts, and then I started crying because I couldn't believe that I could pick up something and take it with me. So, and then especially when I'm in supermarkets and people ask me what I want to eat, I still struggle with that question, because for 5 months no one asked me that question. Well, one person did and I cried. But in those 5 months, no one asked me what I wanted to eat. It was, you'll eat what you're given and you'll be thankful for it. And I was thankful for it. But having that question and that option taken away from me was so difficult. And it was so difficult when that option came back, because I didn't really know what to do with it, or how to handle it, or how to make the most of it. And I didn't know what I wanted, because I was so accustomed just to eating what was in front of me.
Yeah, and that's certainly, if people listen to that and then go to some of the poorer countries and see people in that situation, it may give them an idea of what it must be like to be sitting on the side of the street and not having the choice.
If you see someone sitting on the side of the street, smile at them, because that's the kindest gift you can give them, registering that they're there and that they're a person and that they have feelings. And unfortunately, in our society, we tend to shy away from people on the streets because we get embarrassed. But what we need to do is smile at them and just make them feel happy about being alive and being there. And if you do have some spare time, go up to them and ask them what they would like to eat. Go up and say, would you like a sandwich? Would you like a can of Coke? What would you like me to go and buy you? They might say, I'd prefer you to give me some money so I can go and buy it myself. And then you can do what you see fit. But one of the most impacting things was having that option of what I wanted to eat taken away from me.
My thanks once again to Laura for taking part. Please check out the show notes for both these podcasts. And while you're there, why not join our newsletter and make some suggestions of other people you might like to hear more about? We've got a great lineup so far, and we always welcome more suggestions. And don't forget, there's the monthly competition too, to win over £100 worth of outdoor gear. And you can do that there as well. So until next time, folks, take care out there and bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.